thank you for coming to another installment in our medical ethics series, the Nussbaum Family Medical Halacha and Ethics Institute of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Grateful to Shai Shemayim for hosting. I'll ask people to please silence their cell phones. That would be helpful. A couple of housekeeping items. First of all, there are sign-in sheets over on the table next to the source sheets. Please make sure that you sign in particular if you want CME credit. We can't give CME credit if somebody says I was there, but they didn't sign in. So that is significant. Also, though, we use the email addresses to be able to keep you posted on the sessions. I also like to send out follow-up emails after the sessions related to questions that come up during the class with a link to the audio recording. So if you're on the email list, you'll get that as well. I should note, there's also a column on the sign-in sheet that you can use to sign up for emails about classes in general beyond the medical ethics ones. That's the last column. If you put a check in that box, then you'll get information about classes in general. Leave it blank or write absolutely not, then you won't get those notifications. In the event that you received the notification about this class, that means you are already on the email list for this series, and you don't actually need to write in your email address. Just putting in your name is sufficient. I also want to make sure to note that coming up on December 25th, during Hanukkah, we have a day-long program of my Beit Midrash, Tanakh, Book of Failure, ? We're going to have 13 stories of failure found in a Tanakh, or apparent failure, and we're going to ask what we're supposed to learn from those stories. It runs from 9 a.m. till 4:30 p.m. There's also a free pizza lunch. We do ask that people register in advance. All the information is on the flyer, which you can also find over by the source sheets and sign-in sheets. It's not going to be here. It's going to be at Yeshivat Or Chaim. What I say here is not to be taken as a psak, as a halachic ruling. It is not to be taken as a medical ruling either. It is actually what I would consider sort of the cumulative result of 7 years of first thoughts on this topic, thanks to Barry Pekus, who's right over there, who was my chavrusa for a couple of years. We used to study together, and we focused on public health ethics with a lot of what we did. And a lot of this is influenced by the conversations that we had. So I'm not sure if that's a thank you or a blame. We'll see how things turn out. The truth of the matter is, as you'll see when we go through the material, it's striking that there is a paucity of source material on these issues in the period that we identify as the period of the Rishonim as well as the early Achronim. Basically, the period, call it roughly 6th, 7th century Common Era, all the way through until, call it really the 18th and 19th centuries. No one is really discussing these issues in a way that relates clearly to our topic. You find some Talmudic sources which you can bring to bear, and we're going to talk about those. And then, of course, you find a flourishing of literature in Israel today, where this is a live issue. But there's a huge gap in between, so that whereas normally in our discussions we would be looking at a chain of literature that goes generation by generation, in this case, what we're really going to be doing is trying to see what we can find in the earliest sources and seeing the way that it's used in contemporary discussion about our topic, which is communal spending for medical needs. I wanted to begin with a key source, and source number one, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, familiar I think to many of you. He's actually going to be in Toronto, when is it?
February
8th. Okay, he's going to be in Toronto February 8th. He is both a leading rabbi and halachic authority globally today, as well as a pediatric neurologist. So he comes to this with knowledge of both. He is the author of the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Halacha, Jewish Medical Ethics, I should say. He has a new series of books called Harfu'aka Halacha, Healing According to Jewish Law, which is fantastic. And I used pieces of it, you'll see, quoted on these sheets. And source number one comes from that. As is my practice in these classes, I brought you the Hebrew originals for my my sources, but I'm only going to read aloud my English translations in the interests of time. But you have both there, with the exception being several of the sources where I just got tired of translating and I was already at 7 pages and I said, you know what, these sources don't need to appear in translation, but I'm going to explain them in the course of the class. I apologize, but there are 40 sources on the sheet. So if you take a look at source number one, he writes, the community is obligated to allocate resources for health, preventive medicine, active health care. Active is it's really a term that makes more sense in Hebrew, refuah pe'ilah. It means healing, as opposed to preventive medicine, for the community and for each individual. But this allocation must consider other public needs, like security, education, housing, which in and of itself is not anything anybody wouldn't know. But the question now is, it's all well and good to say that, how does this work in practice? How do we allocate for these various needs, recognizing the breadth of needs as well as the depth of needs medically and beyond? And so I broke this down into 5 questions, which you can see there on the sheet. My goal is that in our 90 minutes we get through all 5. It's a goal, you know, it's important to have dreams. We'll see what we actually get to. But let's go through the questions briefly, and as we take them one by one, I'll open it for discussion. But right now I just want to lay out the outline of what we want to address. The first one, does Judaism recognize a duty for society to fund medical care? Now, we've already presented Rabbi Steinberg's answer to that question, but I want to ask it in a little bit of a more complicated way, which is, so what is that duty? Where does that come from? Because there's more than one potential answer to that question. Having addressed that, then I want to move into the following. The Financial Accountability Office determined that healthcare received 41% of program spending by the government of Ontario in 2018-2019. For 2020-2021, the government would like to reduce that percentage in order to increase spending on education. Pause here. Sorry, I should have made this more clear in my question. The first sentence is fact. The second sentence is my hypothetical. That should be clarified. I don't need any calls for any government officials. That's just for the sake of the question. So yes, it is fact. 41% of program spending by the government of Ontario in 2018-2019 was on healthcare. Let's say the government would like to reduce that percentage. May the government promote education over healthcare? And again, we're going to discuss it when we get to that unit of the session. And then, within healthcare, how does allocation work? This also is hypothetical. The government of Canada recognizes rising risks to national health in the opioid crisis and wishes to support research with healthcare funds. Is this an acceptable use of healthcare dollars? Again, that's a hypothetical. This is not a statement of anything the government is actually doing. Ditto for number 4. Israel's Likud party forms a coalition government via an alliance with religious parties. And as part, they should actually manage to form a coalition government. However, let's say that actually happens. Some things are more hypothetical than others. And as part of the deal, Rabbi Yochanan Rofei becomes Minister of Health. Rabbi Rofei wants to have rabbis determine the basket of services supported by national health care. Would this be a halachically correct approach to the allocations process? Halacha, Jewish law. Would Jewish law say that rabbis should be in charge of the allocations process? And if so, just how many people are actually going to get medicine? But by the time we come to a conclusion. And then the last one, and this actually, this was a case that I found in a paper on healthcare issues. Ms. Johnson comes to her physician with symptoms of gastric reflux. Her doctor gives her a prescription for, I'm going to mispronounce this, cimetidine? Yes, right. Okay. Even though he knows, I'm going to get it wrong again, omeprazole? Yes. Really? Ha! Would be better at relieving her symptoms. He thinks the cost of this other medication is too high for it to be the initial treatment. Is this consistent with a Jewish perspective on healthcare spending decisions? Okay, he gives the prescription for the cheaper one, even though the more expensive one would do a better job. Is this considered to be consistent with a Jewish perspective on healthcare spending decisions to say, let's have a work with the cheaper one first and see how effective it is? So the learning objectives that you see there on the sheet are the first two are the ones that we submitted to when we wanted to get accreditation for this. The third one was one that I felt it was important to add. Our objectives are that by the end of the session, participants will appreciate the challenges facing the Ontario healthcare system in balancing spending priorities, understand the complexity of patient healthcare decisions, and particularly the impact of Jewish ethics on those decisions, and appreciate the role of clinical healthcare professionals in stewardship of healthcare resources. Ambitious, but let's see what we can do. So let's tackle the first one, the first piece of this. What would be the nature of society's duty to fund medical care? As opposed to saying everybody who needs it should just go for it and pay for whatever they can pay for, what would be the basis for society having an obligation to fund healthcare?
Society being government.
In other words, the leadership of the community acting on behalf of the community, using money, which obviously comes from the community, but is not spent and directed by individuals, but instead is overseen by the central authority. Johans?
Risk of contagion.
Risk of contagion. What does that mean? Yeah.
So there's an interest, for instance, in immunizing. There's an interest that the public has to reduce the impact to vulnerable parties.
Mm-hmm. So one way to look at it, I'm not sure this is where you're going, but it sounds like it to me, is to simply say the community has an interest in making sure that people are healthy, both the individuals and because of the impact that an individual's health has on the community as a whole, and therefore they should look after this just as they look after other needs of the community. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, I brought you an idea like this from Rabbi Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, as quoted by his son-in-law Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein. Much of what is discussed on the issues in Israel today stems to Rabbi Elyashiv's positions. He was very influential in this area. So you can see that the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English on the top of the next side. He's talking about how to invest. And what he says in number 4 is going to be significant repeatedly as we visit this topic. He's talking about the question, technically he's talking about the question of distribution of resources. And look what he says. By law we must save, by law he means Jewish law, we must save the greatest number of ill people and to invest financially in emergency care and a NICU and not in a transplant unit. The reason he says that is because the transplant unit is going to cost a lot more and save fewer people as you run it compared to these other units. But one cannot close or fail to open a transplant unit because communal needs are also considered life-saving. Meaning, even if it's true, I can save more lives by running, by putting more money into emergency care. Nonetheless, there is a communal need for transplant, and therefore it is significant. He says if a transplant unit would be closed, it would cause low morale, and people would refuse to live there. So he makes a point, which again, I want to revisit later, but the element that I'm bringing of it right now is that he considers public morale to be an important component in calculating how you're going to spend. It is to the benefit of the community as a whole, and that's part of the mandate of the government to provide this benefit, to make sure it is a place where people want to live, where they have confidence in their healthcare system. And that may mean that you fund things which aren't necessarily going to maximize the number of lives saved. So one basis for this idea is simply that we are looking after the welfare of the community to make sure it functions as a community. The truth of the matter is, I cannot find a legal source in primary Jewish text, going back to the Talmud, to support this contention. The idea that community government has some kind of responsibility to make sure that people are confident and want to live there, I struggle to find the basis for it. He does not, when Rabbi Zilberstein quotes Rabbi Yashiv did not write on this to the extent of my knowledge, but when Rabbi Zilberstein quotes him, he doesn't provide a textual basis for it. It is simply fiat, this is so. But that's one take. What else? What else might be a basis? Chaim. So Chaim points out what I would call a first approach to this, even before the approach of Rabbi Yashiv. He quotes you a biblical verse which says, you are responsible to guard your lives. And indeed, we have several commandments, several mitzvot, in which we are taught that we are responsible as individuals to, number one, look after our own lives, and number two, look after the lives of others. Right? V'lo tamod al dam re'acha. Don't stand by while somebody else's blood is shed. Hashavat aveda. There is a responsibility that if somebody loses his property, I am responsible to help restore it to him. So too, if somebody loses her health, I am responsible to try to restore it to her. Ve'avta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. So one school of thought says, look at the community as a set of individuals. Individuals have certain responsibilities. It must be that the community, as the aggregate of individuals, carries the same set of responsibilities or a similar one. If you look on your sheet at source number 2, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was a major authority in Jewish law, specifically in medical ethics. Towards the end of the 20th century, he passed away, I think, in 2003. He was the de facto rabbi for many doctors at Shaare Tzedek Hospital for many, many years, and he answered many questions regarding medical care. So take a look at what he says in this source. He's talking here, in this responsum, he was asked about, I think it was a yeshiva, where there were a number of students who had vision problems. And their parents had not looked after their eye care. And the question was, what's the institutional responsibility towards them? I believe that was the case. So look at what he says here. It was so obvious to halachic authorities that there is such a duty, meaning to pay for an ill person's treatment, upon all those around the ill person. Everyone around the ill person has such a responsibility, to the point that they debated a case in which the community had spent for this without asking the ill person, is the ill person obligated to repay them for their expenditures since they were obligated to do this, right? In other words, if the community took care of somebody's medical needs, cost them money, do they have the right to go back to that patient and say, we'd like to be reimbursed, or maybe not, because you had a moral obligation to help this person by spending. He says, based on what has been said, it is clear and simple that the government, which must have the health of society as its top concern, must also allocate funds to help prevent the development of this disease of nearsightedness by providing the necessary treatment via expert doctors, and so on. He takes the view that just as the individuals who know somebody is in need have a responsibility to take care of that person, so too the community as a whole takes on that kind of obligation. He's not the only one. There are others who write similar ideas, 18th century, 19th century, and if not as a direct statement of Jewish law, they take it as a statement of Jewish ideals. Source number 3 is one of the sources that I did not translate, but I'm going to explain it now. Rabbi Waldenberg is writing there as well. It's really a footnote in a responsum of his, in which he says how good it is that you have kupot hacholim, right? Collections for those who are ill in various forms. He doesn't mean here kupat cholim in Israel today, which is the term for the health insurance that you are contributing towards. He means collections that are charitable. So he says you have these multidimensional charities for people who are ill found in our holy land in Israel. And he says, these people exemplify a trait that Jews are supposed to be known for. He quotes you a passage in the Talmud which says the three hallmarks of the Jew are supposed to be Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasadim. That they are supposed to be merciful, they are supposed to be modest, and they are supposed to be generous. This is supposed to be these are aspirations that Jews are supposed to be identified in this way. And so he argues that the community, when they do this, are fulfilling these ideals, but also the community has a duty to meet that, to carry out those activities which would fulfill the obligations upon each individual. Not everybody agrees with him. Right, Moshe Hirschler, prominent writer on medical ethics in Israel going back about 50, 60 years ago, disagreed. And he felt that you can't extrapolate from the obligations of individuals to the obligations of the community. Just as the Torah says, don't stand by while someone's blood is shed, to individuals does not mean that the same rule is going to pertain to the community. But that's a view. So right now we have presented two views, two approaches to why the Jewish community would have an obligation to look after the health and fund the health care of people who are ill. Those are two views, but there's a third view that's really important. Take a look, please, at your sheet at source number 5, a Talmudic source. Yes. Good. So,
you know, local, city, Jewish community, Ontario, Canada, the world Jews.
Right. So Jeff asks a really important question, which is, how exactly do you define community? It seems to be clear that it applies even to the smallest municipal level, the most local level. However, if we get there, we'll see. Source number 39, which that's the right before the review questions at the end. Rabbi Shlomo Dykovsky makes a very interesting observation in which he claims that the entire state of Israel counts as one community, which has serious ramifications, which we'll have to talk about. But God willing, we'll get there. But take a look at number 5, please. Number 5 takes an entirely different approach. It says this is not about religious obligations at all. It's not about Rabbi Waldenberg's point about individual religious obligations. It's not about some amorphous concept of the community is supposed to look after the health of and the ongoing existence of the community. It's social contract. The Talmud states, townspeople may make rules for measures and prices and wages and may fine those who violate the norms. The community is able to say, you're a member of the community, we want you to pay in. And therefore, if a community decides that this is something that's important for them, community at any level, decides this is something that we wish to fund, social contract states, now the members of the community, those who live there, are going to be required to fulfill that which the community has established. Social contract is a political thing rather than a religious one. There's actually a fourth and last view that I want to mention. I find it to be fascinating. Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport is the grandson of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was the leading authority, certainly in North America, if not the world, in Jewish law for much of the 20th century. He passed away in 1986. His grandson, Rabbi Rappaport, has developed a name in his own right, and a lot of what he says is based on ideas of his grandfather. And he argues that the community has a special duty to eliminate injustice. And people lacking health care is itself injustice. It's a very interesting argument. He bases it on the way that Maimonides, the Rambam, articulates the obligation to give tzedakah, to give charity. Take a look at sources 6 and 7. Charity is not a good translation of the word tzedakah. I stipulate that now, but I'm going to use it because it's one that people often use. Nonetheless, Rambam, Maimonides, in number 6, articulates the obligation to give tzedakah. He says, there is a commandment to give tzedakah to paupers as suits them, if the donor can afford it. Meaning, whatever it is that is appropriate for the standard of living of this person, whatever standard of living the person is used to, that's what you're supposed to fund if you can afford it. As the Torah says, you shall surely open your hand for him and give him his deficit, which is lacking for him, whatever it is that he's lacking. So if he, as a child, grew up in a home in which they had a fancy car, in which they had, I don't know what, fill in your own imagination, then that's what you're supposed to provide if you can afford it. If the pauper requests his deficit and the donor cannot afford it, he gives as he can afford. How much? Ideally up to one-fifth, 20% of his assets. One-tenth is average, less than that is stingy. That's Maimonides regarding the individual's obligation to give tzedakah. But then take a look at source number 7. There, Maimonides is talking about the community. And he says, one who dwells in a land for 30 days is compelled to give tzedakah to the kupa, which is the weekly collection, along with the citizens of the community. One who dwells there for 3 months is compelled to give to the tamchui, which was a daily collection of food that would be, again, distributed in the community. It's interesting. Maimonides actually writes, I didn't bring it here, but Maimonides writes, he says, I have never heard of a Jewish community which did not have a kupa, which did not have a weekly tzedakah collection. He can't fathom that idea. So he says, one who dwells there for 6 months is compelled to give clothing for the local needy. One who dwells there for 9 months is compelled to give tzedakah for burial. Rabbi Rappaport points out that the set of needs that are being filled in source number 6 is different from the set of needs being filled in source number 7. Number 6 is talking about the individual giving tzedakah, right? What need is the person supposed to fill when he gives tzedakah? The individual's needs, whatever that is, right? De machsoro, whatever his deficit is. What about when the community gives? What is the community supposed to provide in source number 7? So the kupa and tamchui seem to be driven by food. Food, clothing, burial. What happened to the whole, whatever the person is used to having? That is not mentioned there at all. So he suggested the following, and it's consistent with more sources. He brings a more broad and full discussion of it. But what he suggests is the Sefer HaChinuch, a book that takes upon itself to explain each of the Torah's mitzvot. The Sefer HaChinuch says when it comes to individual tzedakah, the mitzvah is not specifically about now you are enabling somebody else to have what they need. It's also about teaching yourself to be generous. We train ourselves in generosity by giving to others. I forget who it was who I heard once say that people need exercise writing a check. There's a certain muscle involved, and they need exercise in there's some fundraiser somewhere. They only need exercise in that regard. But the Rambam writes that. Maimonides writes that. He talks about the question of whether it's better to give a single large gift to one recipient or whether it's better to give many small gifts to a bunch of recipients. And Maimonides writes, it's better to give many smaller gifts. Not small to the point of insignificance, obviously, but the idea is, it's exercise. You practice it, you become a more generous person. That, he says, is true when you're dealing with an individual. However, when you're dealing with a community, it's a different story. Take a look at source number 8, where I quote you from Rabbi Rappaport's article. He says, in contrast, the reason for the community's obligation in tzedakah is not to teach them mercy. Teaching and habituation do not seem at all relevant for a community. The community is obligated to remove injustice from their midst, and the presence of people who lack their basic needs in a community which possesses its basic needs is true injustice. So he argues that the mandate is social justice. I mention it, but I'm going to have a hard time actually applying it, because he doesn't do much to define what exactly is called injustice, meaning what constitutes their needs, what level of salary, what type of food. I don't get enough explanation here other than maybe what he means is food, clothing, and burial. Maybe that's his definition. It's really unclear. I'm going to stick with the first three as opposed to that one, but I brought it because I thought it was a very interesting idea. So the first three ideas, and they're going to matter as we go through the rest of our discussion. The first three ideas as far as what it is that underlies our obligation to look after people as a community is either extrapolation from our private obligations, or by Waldenberg's idea, or the good of the community itself is a duty of the government, That was Rabbi Eliashiv's idea. Or the idea that the community simply creates the obligation, where the community says, we want to fund healthcare, now everybody has to pay into it, and that's going to be the responsibility of the governors, because it was the community making that determination. It's going to matter, again, which choice, which one you choose. So, that brings us to our second question here, which is, when you're choosing how much to spend on healthcare, how do you balance medical care and other social needs? Right? The question that I articulated in the second vignette. You spent 41% last year. 41% of what the government is spending on programs goes to healthcare. What if the government says, we'd like to drop that? We'd like to make that 35%. Take the 6% and put it instead into education. Is the government entitled to decide to do that? And if so, on what basis, and how do you make that determination? What would you say? Hi.
Well, are you talking about reducing percentage of spending or reducing objective spending? It's a big difference. If you're talking about an increase in overall budget increase, but you're reducing the percentage, you can sell an overall objective increase of spending.
Let's say you wanted to do numbers. Let's keep it simple. Okay, let's pretend that they spent, I'm going to make up numbers, these numbers are not real. Okay, I'm going to make up that the province spent, $50 million on medicine 1 year, and now they want to say, you know what, we're going to spend $45 million next year, we're going to take the $5 million and we're going to put it into teacher salaries. I'm not talking about cutting back on everybody. I'm talking about taking funds that last year went for healthcare and this year are not going to, which will have concrete and tangible results in terms of the reduction of services. Sorry? As a question, how do you even make such a calculation? Is there a right? Oh, let me word it a little bit differently, and I think this may make it easier to answer. If I am aware that there is a human being in the next room who needs money in order to survive, right? They don't have money to be able to buy dinner tonight. So I have an obligation to give them money so that they can buy dinner tonight. Let's say I'm holding $10. I can give it to them to buy dinner tonight. Or, on the other hand, there's somebody else who wants to be able to go on a trip somewhere. Somebody else who wants to be able to, I don't know what, buy a Hanukkah gift for their kid or whatever it is. I could give them the $10. I think it's fairly safe to say my $10 goes to the person who needs food. Right? I'm stipulating that. That's true. So, by what authority would government be able to say, we're not putting 100% of what we have into healthcare? Forget the roads, forget the classes, forget the art museum. Let's just put it all into healthcare. Go to that extreme. What is it that allows the government to say, we're not doing that? We're going to account for other social needs as well. It's clear that government does account for other social needs as well. I'm asking what the legal basis is for it. Yes?
Well, I would go back to one of your points that says that you have to make the community desirable for people to live in.
Right. So that's going to be one of the arguments, is going to be desirability of the community. It goes back to the question of which approach you take. If you take the approach that government is indeed responsible to look after both the survival of the community and the desirability of the community, then you'll say people don't want to live in a community that may have great hospitals, but doesn't have anything else. The roads are, different or whatever, and the schools are inadequate and so forth. People aren't going to want to live there. That's an argument you can indeed make, and we will. What else might be an argument for it? Yeah.
Education improves health.
Education improves health. To expand even beyond that, roads improve health. Right? Education, one would hope, would improve health. Safety on the roads would also be said to improve health. There are a bunch of other needs which, when you meet them, may well improve not just quality of life, but life itself for the community. And that may be an argument we make. Take a look on your sheets, please. Source number 9. an essay called Who Should Be Responsible for Healthcare? A majority of Canadians believe that healthcare should be the federal government's top priority and that Ottawa should play a leading role in protecting and strengthening the healthcare system. A new, this was 2012, EGOS poll conducted on behalf of the CMA indicates. 3 in 4 Canadians said healthcare should be the federal government's top priority. I assume math is not the top priority, which is why they give you 75% in parentheses in case you weren't aware. A large, maybe more went into education the next year. A large majority of respondents, 87%, believe that the federal government should pay more attention to healthcare. 85% believe the government should play a leading role in protecting and strengthening the healthcare system, according to the poll. I should note, that's not just about funding it. That's also about administering it. The source number 10 is where I got my numbers on the 41%. That I mentioned in the question. So the issue here is society wants to do more in terms of healthcare. What happens to these other needs? Interestingly, quite a few arguments in the Jewish sources on this. Try to claim that other expenditures have the status of life-saving. Then we're going to see some of those arguments. Honestly, as I go through them, I think the arguments are stretched. I think they're used beyond where they should be. But we're going to see how this works. There are two key sources in the Talmud in this regard. So the first source to see is number 11. Again, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English on the top of the next side. This is a source that goes back to a phenomenon which unfortunately was quite common in Talmudic times. The issue of people being taken captive. And I'm just going to set up my other recorder here because the first one, I see the battery is dying and I know it's only a matter of time before it goes. So I'm going to preempt it by just pausing it.
Okay, backup recorder is working. So the phenomenon was that Jews would find themselves taken captive in Roman times, and then the community would be called upon to ransom them. If you failed to ransom somebody, they might be sold as a slave, or they might be killed. So the Talmud has the following discussion. What's the cap? What's the maximum the community should be willing to pay in order to ransom someone? So the Mishnah, the core text of the Talmud, you're going back now 2,000 years, says one may not redeem captives for more than their value. What is their value? The general assumption, not everybody agrees, but the general assumption is it means whatever the going rate is on the slave market for them in this period 2,000 years ago. That was what you should not pay more than. Why? Due to tikkun ha'olam. Tikkun ha'olam, literally repair of the world. So the sages ask, what exactly does that mean when you say tikkun ha'olam? Does tikkun ha'olam mean you don't want to create too much of a burden on the community? Meaning, in the event that I'm making up numbers, the going rate on the slave market is they should have been sold for $1,000. However, their captors are demanding $100,000, and we're saying it's just too much. You can't put that kind of financial burden on the community. Or is it referring to a concern that the captors may capture and bring more captives? Is the issue not about this person, but in the event that you pay this ransom, even if it's low, you're going to encourage the captors to do it again. You make it a good business. So even if the captors just demand $500, by you paying, you establish a precedent, and the community is now going to be faced with more such kidnappings. That's the question which the Talmud does not decisively resolve. But we have a statement that there is a cap on what you're supposed to pay. Not only that, but some commentators argue that cap applies even if it is a life and death case. Even in the event that you know that this person is in fact going to be killed because you didn't ransom him, her, you're still not supposed to ransom them for more than this capped number. So the sages look at this and say, I don't understand. This person's going to lose their life. How is it that you're willing to say, we're not going to pay for this person's ransom. You see the problem. How can that be? So take a look at source number 12. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, at the end of the 18th century, offers you the following explanation. He says the Rabbeinu Nisim, who he's quoting, talks about spending all of one's money and using tzedakah and so forth. Well, let me give you a little bit of background before we see this line in number 12. He's talking first about the mitzvah of not standing by while somebody's blood is shed, which is a prohibition. You're not allowed to stand by. When it comes to prohibitions, biblical prohibitions, there's a rule. If I personally have a prohibition that I'm having a hard time fulfilling, let's say I am in a place where kosher food is only available at a very, very, very high price. Okay? I know everybody thinks kosher food is really expensive. I get it. But I'm talking beyond that. Okay? If I am in a situation in which kosher food is only available if I pay a very, very, very high price, am I allowed to say, it's too high, I'm just going to go with non-kosher food? Am I entitled to say that? So the answer is no. I may well be able to say, for active commandments, that it's too expensive. If olive oil for Hanukkah is at a point where no one can afford it, so maybe I'm able to say it's too much. The truth is, the Talmud says you have to go very, very far in order to get fuel for your menorah, so that's probably not the best example, but you can use any other example you want. Generally speaking, when it comes to fulfilling a commandment, I can cap what I'm supposed to pay. If I can't get a lulav and etrog for Sukkot, other than by paying an exorbitant sum, so I don't have to. However, to avoid violating a prohibition, I have to spend whatever I have to spend. So if that's what it takes to get kosher food, then that's what I'm supposed to do. So then the question comes up, what about when it comes to ransoming a captive? You have a prohibition. The prohibition is don't stand by while someone else's blood is shed. So don't you have to spend everything you have in order to avoid violating the prohibition? So so that's where Rabbi Moshe Sofer comes in. And he says, Rabbeinu Nisim only said this, that you have to spend whatever you have for an individual, that he must spend all his money and demand communal support and receive from the tzedakah rather than violate a prohibition. Meaning, you have to spend everything you can to get kosher food, and then you have to look for help from the community. But if a community is pressed, and especially when the nations are in control of what he calls euphemistically the enemies of Israel, he means us, then communal strain is included as a life-saving situation. He says draining the community of its funds is itself considered what's called in Hebrew pikuach nefesh. It is called a life-saving situation, and he quotes you a couple of sources to support that idea, including what I brought you here in number 13. And that's one of those sources that I didn't translate, but I will explain it now. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 13, is dealing with the question of altering or diverting communal tzedakah funds. Meaning, normally the rule is somebody gives money allocating it for a particular use, that's where it has to go. It's simply a matter of honesty that you use it the way that they established it. That's the rule. However, take a look at number 13, where they talk about the question of altering and diverting communal tzedakah funds for a particular use. And what the Code of Jewish Law writes is this. He says, you're allowed to alter, to divert communal funds, even if they were intended for Torah study, which is a high priority. You're allowed to divert them for the sake of providing 30 coins that have to be paid to the local government every year. There was a non-Jewish government. They demand a tax on the community of 30 coins. Divert communal tzedakah funds for that purpose. Why? He says, because you are saving lives by doing so. Because in the event that you would not do that, in the event that you don't pay this sum of money to the local government, then the government is going to come after needy people and is going to take whatever they have. Literally, he says, Yakum v'yavshitum arumim, they will hit them and they will take their clothing instead. So that Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, says, look at what the Code of Jewish Law said in number 13. It said there that the need for the community to be able to pay this tax is like life and death. Even though the government is not actively going to kill them if they can't pay the tax, nonetheless, the communal need rises to the level of life and death, and he is willing to apply that in the context of ransoming captives. So this is one source that is brought.
Not to ransom them.
So this is one source that is brought to support the idea that communal needs may well be considered life and death. Now, I think you could argue this point, because the sources that they bring are sources that are fairly dire. They're not at the level of, with all due respect to culture, they're not at the same level as spending on culture. They're still, you know, the concerns for needy people being abused by the government because they couldn't pay the tax. It's not the same level. Nonetheless, that's one source. The other source is source number 14. Yes. Right, Waldenberg, you're saying, is saying that the individual responsibility creates the community. Right, that's correct. He is arguing that. Well, it is. I don't think he's disagreeing. I think it's sort of orthogonal. Like they're really coming at it from different perspectives. Meaning, right, Waldenberg is talking about the community's duty to help others. What Rabbi Sofer here is talking about is how we view the community's own needs, and saying that the community's own needs will outweigh even the life and death needs of a particular individual. You can satisfy both.
An individual couldn't save, but a community can save.
Correct. In that sense, it's different. But I don't think that that's necessarily one versus the other, meaning I think you could sustain that for both. I don't think Rabbi Waldenberg is disagreeing with this point. The other source that is quoted to this effect is source number 14. This is a source we've discussed in other contexts as well. It's a classic. Talmud has a discussion. A spring is owned by a certain town. There is a choice between their lives, meaning the lives of the townspeople who have the spring, by giving them access to the spring, and the lives of other people. In other words, the people upstream want to use the water for themselves. However, the people downstream want the water for themselves. People upstream say, well, this is our life. Their lives come before those of others. If you need this water for your own life, you use it. Their animals precede the animals of others. My animals need the water, I take it for my animals as opposed to letting your animals have it. And if there is a choice between their laundry and that of others, their laundry comes before that of others. If there is a choice between the lives of others and their own laundry, so the people upstream want to use it for laundry. The people downstream want to use it to drink. The lives of others precede their own laundry upstream. So far, so good? We understand that? Rabbi Yossi disagrees. He says no. He says their own laundry precedes the lives of others. The laundry upstream precedes the lives of the people downstream. Why would that be? What is Rabbi Yossi's logic here?
People can suffering.
So one approach, indeed, Yisrael Unterman, in Israel, actually took that position. He said, Isser Yehuda Unterman, that's his name. Sorry, Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman took that position. He said, it doesn't mean it's literally life and death for the people downstream. They can move. It would annoy them. It would be hard. People suffer when they move. But it's not really life and death. And that's one argument. Janine, you were going to say? Correct. So some commentators make the suggestion that the concern regarding laundry is the long-term impact. This isn't one day of not having laundry. If they are going to go without clean laundry for a period of time, it is potentially going to lead to disease. It is potentially going to lead as well to emotional health issues. And so some make that argument. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbeinu Nisim, writing in 14th century Spain, says Rabbi Yossi believes that since preventing laundry involves great pain for the community, this is life-saving. So that is brought to argue once again that communal needs have the status of life-saving as well. That's a second classic source that is brought to support that idea, and therefore the community is entitled to say, we're not spending all the funds available on healthcare, we're also going to spend on other communal needs. One last source in this regard, I brought you a number 16, is dealing with something called Arnona. What is Arnona in modern Hebrew? Sorry? It's a property tax, right? It's a property tax in Israel. So classically, going back to Talmudic times, it was a head tax. And the Talmud talks about the following case. Community of individuals who need to pay the head tax can't afford to do it. It's now the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, when you're not allowed to work your fields, you're not allowed to grow produce, and that's why they're not able to afford the tax, because they don't have any product out of their fields. And the Talmud says that they were allowed to do work in their fields during the sabbatical year, even though it is apparently biblically prohibited. Nonetheless, you're allowed to do it in order to pay this tax. Tosfot, writing in Western Europe, you see it there, 12th, 13th centuries. It's an anthology of comments to the Talmud, asks the question, how could you permit a biblical prohibition in order to pay the tax? So his first answer is maybe it's talking about a period of time in our history when the prohibition against working the field during the sabbatical year was actually rabbinic. That's his first answer. And then his second answer is to say, because if they can't pay the tax, they aren't going to be able to pay the tax, the king may well imprison them, and they may die in prison. And therefore, again, this is a communal need, and that rises to the level of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives. Rabbi Shlomo Dykovsky, a rabbi in Israel today, prominent writer on issues of halacha and government, argues that this is another source for the value in communal needs, like life and death. Although, again, I would argue, I think he's going beyond his sources. I think it actually is a life and death discussion here. But now let's take these sources and apply them to our discussion. Okay? Again, our question is, what is it in Jewish law that entitles the government to spend on needs other than health care? And we saw two Talmudic sources. One, the cap on ransoming captives. Number two, the Rabbi Yossi's view that your laundry may come first, along with this other idea about working the field when it's prohibited in order to pay the king's tax. So if you take the first approach, that the community's obligation for providing for medical care is extrapolated from the individual's obligation, it's the community's just a set of individuals, then it's actually relatively easy. Most halachic authorities argue that an individual is not obligated to spend all of his or her money to save the lives of others. You don't have a personal responsibility to do that, right? Every time that I turn on the radio or look online or, I don't know, for those who still do it, watch television, and there's a report that people are suffering from a hurricane, people are suffering from a drought, people are suffering from whatever, fill in the blank, I am not obligated to open my checkbook and divest myself of all of my funds in order to be able to spare them of their suffering. It's simply not my obligation. Source number 17 supports it, but in the interest of time, I'm going to jump source number 17, but he indeed makes that point. So just like we say that individuals are not obligated to spend everything they have in order to save others, so too I am not obligated to spend everything I have in order to save others. That's one argument that may be brought. If I take approach number two, right? Approach number two was that the community has a duty to look after the welfare of the community as a whole. Then you come back to if you take approach number two, which is the community has an obligation to look after the ongoing welfare of the community to make sure that it will continue to exist, so you make the argument that these other needs are indeed considered to be that which makes sure the community exists. This need to look after the welfare of the community is what we're talking about in the laundry discussion. It's what we're talking about in the cap on what you pay in order to ransom captives. And that takes us back to source number 18, where Rabbi Zilberstein is quoting his father-in-law. And the comment that he made before about public morale. He says, therefore, because we're concerned about public morale, even though the transplant unit needs a greater budget, which could have been used to save many lives, still the very existence of such a unit calms the community, as they know that in a time of need, they could receive a transplant there. And that itself is like saving a life. The existence of such a unit calms the community, and morale is crucial. So there is a cap on what I will be expected to do. This is also supported in sources 19 and 20, but I'm going to skip them in the interest of time because they just support what we have already said. It is still clear that healthcare is going to be more important than the other needs. I brought as one example of that source number 21, a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, in which one of the sages is criticized for the fact that his ancestors spent a lot of money on building great buildings for synagogues, because, you know, there were people who you could have supported with the money that you used for the building. Again, leave aside the discussion because we need buildings too. But the point right now is simply that, yes, healthcare, saving lives, is still going to be number one, but not number one without a number two. There are still these other priorities. So again, if I take approach number one, or maybe I should have structured it this way. If I take approach number one, that the goal is for the community of individuals to satisfy their obligations towards others, I know that individuals are not obligated to spend all of their funds in order to support others. They're also entitled to keep funds for themselves. We have a cap on what we spend on tzedakah. In the event that you take approach number two, that it's looking after the welfare of the community, we saw sources that support the idea that the welfare of the community includes not just the obvious life and death, but also other needs, like the laundry case. And then if you take the third approach was that it's simply social contract, then the community gets to decide whatever it wishes. It's up to the community in establishing its social contract to say, this is what we want. Let's move then to the third of our questions. The third one was, the government of Canada recognizes rising risks to national health in the opioid crisis and hypothetically decides they want to support research with healthcare funds. Is it acceptable to take money that is in the healthcare budget and use it for education, which promotes health, as opposed to active health, so to speak, medicine that's actually going to go directly for, money that's going to go directly for saving people's lives? Or in source number 22, as I brought it there, the government of Canada is responsible to look after research among its other responsibilities. They decide we want to move money into some other research that's going to promote promote healthcare. Where would Judaism fall out on that? What would you say? I've been talking straight for a long time, too long. Yeah. So Ellen argues that your research, in fact, is geared towards saving more lives in the future. That's why we do it. So maybe that's a justification. Can anyone argue against that? Yeah. So Chaim quotes you a Talmudic passage which says if you have something that is definite and then you have something that is a possibility, you go with the definite, meaning I know what it looks like when I'm saving people in the emergency room. I don't have any guarantees about where my research is going to lead. Right? A bird in the hand, as they say. Not quite the same, but anyway. What other arguments could you bring?
Just against Chaim's argument, you don't know whether it's definite until you prove it's definite by research.
Is that always true, though?
Not always, but yeah. It can be.
I mean, research will make other life-saving options definite in the future. That's the expectation. How much are we willing to trust in... Sorry?
How much
Right. Then you get into the question of proportion. If you're going to do it at all, then what's your proportion? So I want to go back again to our three approaches, the three approaches that we had to why we do this at all. If I take the view that the community is obligated as a set of individuals, then I go back to what an individual is obligated to provide on behalf of others. So how would we view that? Let's talk about, for example, preventive medicine. Okay, preventive medicine that is going to be used for people today. Take a look, please, at source number 23, Rabbi Rappaport. He says, it appears clear that we should distinguish between communal considerations and personal considerations. The individual who, and what he means by that is not the point of communal saving of others and individual saving of others. What he means by that is how we look at prevention and the value of prevention and early intervention. He says, the individual who calculates for himself whether he may, should say may, whether he may eat unhealthy foods or whether it should be prohibited as a threat to his life, may decide leniently because there is no definite danger to life. Right? When I decide what I'm going to eat, I'm entitled to say, I think I'd like a burger. Leave aside recent studies about red meat. Working with the assumption even that it's not so healthy, I'm entitled to say, a certain number of burgers isn't really going to hurt me, the studies, the statistics, whatever it is. But when the community calculates education for proper nutrition, there is no doubt that of the community which eats unhealthy food, some of them will be endangered by eating unhealthy food. And education for proper nutrition will save them from an actual threat to life. Therefore, they may direct resources for these needs, even by halting future treatment and surgery, which could save lives. Rabbi Rappaport is actually in a really interesting position because of his grandfather. Rabbi Rappaport's grandfather wrote a responsum in, I think it was the 1950s, regarding the issue of smoking. He was asked whether Jews are allowed to smoke, or, since you're not allowed to endanger your health, whether it should be prohibited. And he did not want to say that it was prohibited, whether because people were addicted to it or whatever the reasoning was. He didn't want to say that it was prohibited. And so Rabbi Rappaport starts his responsum by saying, my grandfather said that people are allowed to smoke. So that biases me towards saying that you don't look to future factors. But then he recants. Because communally, and that's what you see in number 23, he says communally, statistically, there are people who are going to be saved, even if on the individual level you say, well, I can't point to a particular life that I am saving. I would add to that from a source in number 24 that we used in a class last year when we were talking about CPAP machines. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in Israel, former head of one of the departments of internal medicine at Shaare Tzedek Hospital, quoted Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who says, he's describing a patient who suffers from sleep apnea. And he says, such a patient is considered dangerously ill, must use a special device. And he goes on to talk about handling them on Shabbat, handling them on holidays. Those who were here last year remember that discussion. But my point in bringing it is, even though the danger he's talking about is not the danger of somebody who actually that very night may expire because they're not breathing. But he's talking about somebody who is going to have cardiac risk 20 years down the line because of the cumulative impact of sleep apnea. Nonetheless, he's willing to consider that person dangerously ill now and to override certain laws within Judaism in order to enable this person to use the CPAP machine because he considers that person dangerously ill. And even though not everybody agrees and some argue for a lesser classification, all authorities in Jewish law agree that this risk, which is 20 years down the line, is still considered significant today. So if I'm combining now Rabbi Rappaport's point in which he says that from a statistical perspective, when you're dealing with a large population, you are saving people with your work. In this case, that he's talking about public health education, but he also talks about research. Number one, number two, the fact that we do consider a remote danger to still be a threat today, that justifies the idea of working on preventive medicine today. What about, sorry? No? Okay. What about putting aside funds for anticipated healthcare needs? Right? We have statistics. We can say that a certain, not right now, but 5 years from now, we will have a significant chunk of the population that is going to need, I don't want to say something because I'm not a doctor and I have doctors and public health people here, so they can say much better than I can. Tell me something that you might put aside money for because in 5 years it might be a need. Geriatric care?
Marijuana.
Okay. All right. Fair. No, that's fair. Sorry.
An epidemic like SARS.
Okay, an epidemic like SARS? Okay. So you've now heard other cases. I didn't put them forth, so you can all agree or disagree with each other. But basically, the question that we have to ask is it legitimate to put aside funds for the sake of those anticipated needs, knowing that you're not using them for the needs that we know of today? So I got a yes. Okay, on what basis?
Logic.
You have to say for the future. You don't know what's going to happen. You always have to be prepared.
Well,
it's an emergency. You always have to have a contingency.
So even before you get into the question of how much, although that is an important question here, I heard it from this direction somewhere, the issue here is that I'm not saving money. I'm diverting money. The money is coming from somewhere. It's not as though there's a budget right now that has free money sitting around and I'm just putting a label on it. So the money's coming from some other type of treatment.
In the budget, there isn't a contingency fund, usually?
All I know is what I read in the papers, which is that we're using everything we have. And then some. So the truth of the matter is, this is quite controversial in Judaism. It goes back to the 18th century in Prague, and what may fairly be called one of the five most influential, maybe 10, but certainly 10, one of the 10 most, probably one of the top five influential responsa in Jewish law of the last 300 years. Rabbi Yechezkel Landau was the chief rabbi in Prague, and he was asked about autopsy, which is done for the sake of gaining information that might at some point save a life. The issues of autopsy are, number one, potentially degrading the body, depending on how it's done, potentially not burying all of the body, and there's a mitzvah of burial, and certainly delaying the burial of the body. So Rabbi Landau argued you're allowed to autopsy if there is a patient you know of who could be helped with this information. So there's an epidemic going on right now, and somebody died from that epidemic, and we want to do an autopsy in order to learn what we can to help treat other people from that epidemic. Rabbi Landau was fine with that. However, saying we don't know who this is going to help, but we think that the more we know, the better suited we will be, the better situated we will be to help people in the future, he says he's not ready to do that. Take a look at source number 25, in which Rabbi Landau wrote, "All of this," meaning the permission, "is only when we have before us potential danger to life, such as the case of an ill person. But in our case, there is no patient who needs this. They only wish to gain this knowledge such that if an ill person would need it, and for such a concern, for such as that, we don't override any biblical or rabbinic prohibition." He is not willing to allow an autopsy in that case. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, the Binyan Tzion, other authorities of his time followed that that approach. And indeed, Rabbi Zilberstein was asked this question about 30 years ago, and at that time already, you hit a situation in which there's such communication among populations that even if there's no one here who needs it, the information could help somebody in another country. And at this point, later, around the world, does that change it? And he argued that it does not change it. He was not willing to veer from that. Ilana, before I go on, because there's going to be another view, but. Yes.
So, isn't it the same argument could be made for diverting funds from direct patient care to research?
Bingo. That's exactly right. According to Rabbi Landau's position, You should say, you have a chance to save somebody. You have a chance to do research that might help somebody else. You save the people you have and let somebody else worry about research. That seems to be his position. Others, though, disagreed. Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, also known as the Chazon Ish, major authority in Jewish law in Israel in the middle of the 20th century, did not accept that distinction. He says, number 26, the distinction is not, meaning should not be, between those who are present or absent. Do you have somebody here who needs it or not? He doesn't accept that. But whether the situation is common, it is not called potentially life-saving for future matters, which have, it should say, that's my sloppy translation, which have no presence at all now. Meaning, he argues, it isn't about saying there is somebody I know who needs this, but how likely is it that this has a current application? And if it has some level of current application, he is willing to license it. He disagreed. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, student of the Chazon Ish, said the Chazon Ish indeed disagreed with the position of Rabbi Landau. But that's one argument in favor of looking to the future and indeed doing the research or putting aside money, hang on, for anticipated health care needs. Others lobby for allocating for the future based on a different premise. Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan is a rabbi in Israel today who makes the argument that the community has a general obligation to look towards the future, but he doesn't really bring sources, legal sources, that support it. A stronger approach comes from Rabbi Zilberstein, who we've quoted before. And when he makes the argument about a duty to look towards advanced needs, Rabbi Zilberstein talks about the difference between individual and community. And he writes what you see here in number 27. Just as one is not obligated to learn to swim in order to save people who are drowning in a river, right? In other words, I am obligated to learn to swim in order to be safe. I'm obligated to save people if I know how to swim. But no one is going to say that there is an obligation in Jewish law to take swimming lessons in order to be able to serve as a lifeguard. But logically, he says, the community must appoint lifesavers who will learn how to save those who fall in a river and are drowning. So they must find ways to establish a tzedakah collection to feed the needy and to make sure that people will make money such that they will be able to contribute to the needs of that collection, right? In other words, I don't need to get a better paying job. I don't have an obligation to get a better paying job in order to be able to give more tzedakah. The community, though, is responsible to make sure there's a functional economy so that there will be people who will make money and be able, in fact, to give tzedakah. He views that as a function of the community's obligation, which the Rambam talked about, of kupa, which is based on what we already saw in the Rambam when he talked about the fact that you have two different mitzvot, private and communal. So that's the basis for what he says. So he makes the argument that fundamentally the duty to set up a kupa, to set up a tzedakah collection, is a forward-thinking obligation. It says there will be people who are needy, therefore let's set up the means of taking care of them. Same thing is true for healthcare. There will be people who will have different diseases. Let's work today to be able to fund that goal. So that's the argument here in favor of preventive medicine. The argument goes, we're still within approach number one, right? If you're taking approach number one, that the community is obligated like an individual, as a set of individuals, I should say, you make the argument that, well, really it's not. Really it's under the second one. It's not under the first one. It's under the second one. If you take if you take the first approach where the community is obligated like any individual, then you say, well, the individual does not necessarily have such an obligation. However, if you take the view that it's the community acting as a community with the responsibility to look after the welfare of the community, then the argument indeed comes into play that this is part of that responsibility. And of course, if you take the third approach, that the community operates via its own license, by its own social contract, then everything is fair game. It's whatever the community wishes to do. Okay, we have two sections left here, and we have 13 minutes. That's not great. I'm gonna do the best I can though with it, because I think each of these is important. There's one piece that I had that I'm gonna skip that I think is skippable in order to make this work. But I think it will work. Vignette number 4 was the one of, so who exactly is supposed to oversee the allocations process? The Likud government in Israel decides that rabbis should be the ones to oversee this. Who does that and on what basis? So this we can answer pretty easily, right? If you take approach number 1, it's about the individual's halachic obligations extrapolated to the community, then Rabbi Rofe is going to be the one to look after it because it's a halachic obligation. If, on the other end, I take approach number 2, the community's duty to maintain community, then I'm going to go to the researchers on what it takes to maintain community. It's not about a rabbi's decision. It's simply a matter of, you know, sociologists, basically, responding with, this is what a community needs in order to maintain its existence. And in the event that we take approach number 3, that it's the authority of the community itself and their social contract, then I think you go to the elected representatives. Logically, they're the ones who ought to make this decision. And indeed, if you take a look at source number 29, Rabbi Zilberstein takes that approach. He says, it appears that since the community pays the taxes and they fund the hospital, we should weigh what the community prefers. Similarly, my father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv, said regarding the basket of medicines, that since the community pays for the basket of medicines, one should consider that which interests the community more. Whatever it is that interests them. Rabbi Al-Yashiv, of course, is doing it under number 2, which is that he believes it's important for morale. So ask the community what they want. This is how you sustain community morale. Okay. So what principles do you use to govern your decisions about allocating funds when you're deciding where you want to put it? So most argue for a flat priority for life and death needs. Life and death has to, at the end of the day, life and death has to come first. If you take a look at source number 30, I brought it in that source. We saw it in Rabbi Al-Yashiv earlier as well. Rabbi Menashe Klein is dealing with a question which made the rounds among rabbinic authorities. You find quite a few who write about this question. Here, it was a real life question. There was a gentleman who struggled with infertility issues, impotence issues, whatever it was, for many, many years. After years of treatment, whatever they did worked, and he and his wife conceived, and they had a baby. And he was a very wealthy individual. And he said, because I was wealthy, I was able to take advantage of these methods. I would like to make a major donation to a hospital to open a unit where they will treat people who are in this position. And this way, it will be more accessible to the masses. I shouldn't be the only one who benefits. I want others to have this. The administrator in the hospital looks at the donation and says, this is a wonderful gift. But, you know, we could use this. And he has a whole list of ins, right? He says they could use it in geriatric care, I could use it in the NICU, I could use it in emergency care. So there are a bunch of articles that were written to try to address this. Rabbi Menashe Klein, in source number 30, says it depends on how he worded it. If he said, this is number 30, I'm translating it now, but he says, if the donor said that he wants to give a large sum just for taking care of ill people, he didn't say people who had what he had. He just said, I want it to be for people in general, which he says is what appears to have been the text of the letter that he received that supposedly came from the donor. So he says, in that case, if he just wants to take care of people who are ill, then you look at the people who are most ill, and those are the ones that you take care of. You don't use it for fertility. That's the argument that Rabbi Klein gives and others give similar arguments. However, even if you're going to say, let's prioritize the people who are in life and death situations, what do you do about the fact that you could use the same sum of money to save one person or to save 100 people, right? Depending on what the life and death situation is. We talked about it before. We said the transplant unit is going to cost a lot of money that could have been used to save many more people who are in other circumstances. So what do you do at this point? And the answer tends to be that while you would not cut off treatment from somebody who is already receiving it, if you're initiating, you go with the greater number of people and not the individual who's in need, but you're instead going to try to put your money towards helping the maximum number of people. Now, what's your basis for that? Remember, in Jewish law, you always need a source. It isn't enough to say, well, this is logical. Where is your source? It's very interesting because you actually have sources that would seem to say the opposite. You have a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, which I brought you in source number 31. I'll say it outside of the text, in which a caravan is traveling and they're surrounded by bandits. And the bandits say, either turn over one person or we're going to kill everybody. And the rule is you're not allowed to pick somebody to turn over. In the event that they say, we want you to turn over a specific person, they name somebody, then there's a debate. And the reason for the debate is because if you don't turn him over, he's dead anyway. Right? Because they're going to kill everybody anyway. But one of the points that emerges from the discussion is, generally speaking, we will not kill one person in order to save many people. So now you have a situation in which you're allocating funds. Isn't that what you're doing? Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli was a leading authority in Jewish law in the 20th century. And take a look at source number 32, in which he provides a creative basis for this decision. He says, you know, the government has the right to take the nation to war. And not just a war of self-defense either. We could have a whole discussion about the ethics of war. That's not our discussion right now. Take a look at what he says in number 32. It appears to me that one may learn the basis for this, the basis for saving the maximum number of people, from discretionary war, which is for profit, or to expand the control of Israelite reign, or for the sake of the economy. And for this, one may endanger individuals, right? You go to war, people die. And that which people commonly say, well, war is different, war has special legal status, that has no basis. Why can't I deduce from license to go to war? And when people say, well, war was different because it was governed by the Sanhedrin, the high court, a Jewish king was not allowed to take the nation to war on his own say-so, he had to consult the high court. So maybe you can't extrapolate from there. He says, no. Because if it was really a matter of life and death, the Sanhedrin, the high court, would not be entitled to say, well, let's go to war and endanger people. One must say the basis is that anything related to the welfare of the community or removal of harm is called life-saving. For anything involving the welfare of the community has some relationship to life-saving, a point that we made earlier. So he makes the argument that the government indeed has the authority to say the community has a need for which we're going to go to war, and therefore that will override the needs of the individual. Very occasionally, the needs of an individual will still override the needs of the community. That still does happen. Ransoming hostages, sometimes that still happens. But that is a potential basis for explaining how it is that when spending healthcare funds, you would put the money towards the maximum who you are able to help. All right, I'm going to skip a little bit of what's left because I say I have 4 minutes. I'm going to jump to the fifth point, which is the role of the individual clinician, because I think that's too important to just say that we're not going to get to that at all. There's a lot of literature, and I brought you some of it in sources 35, 36, 37, that talks about stewardship and the responsibility of the clinician to act not only as an advocate for the health of the patient, but also to act as a protector of the resources of the system. And the truth of the matter is that there's a knee-jerk reaction, a gut reaction that says, don't do that, right? Someone has to argue on behalf of the patient. If you're going to be a steward of the system, then who is it who's going to argue on behalf of the patient? Isn't it, in fact, a conflict of interest? And to a certain extent, it is a conflict of interest. I brought you number 35, which actually says that explicitly, that physicians have to be aware of that conflict. However, despite that, I think stewardship is actually legitimate within Jewish law. In source number 38, I brought you this from Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, the Chazon Ish. He pointed to a classic Talmudic case. The Talmud discusses the case in which there are two people who are walking in the wilderness, and they know magically that one of them has water, the other one does not. They know magically that if the person who has the water drinks the entire amount, that person will live. The other person won't make it. If they share the water, neither of them makes it. How do they know? They do. So the ruling there in the Talmud is the person who is holding the water gets to drink it. So the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Karelitz, asks the question. Let's say that's not your case. Let's say you're a third party and you're holding the water. To whom do you give it? Do you split it between the two of them? Do you give it to one? And if so, how do you choose which one receives it? And he says the following, which I brought you here in number 38. He says, the Rabbi Akiva, who is the winner in this debate about who gets to use the water when they're holding it themselves, he says, Rabbi Akiva would say, give it to whichever one you want. You are the one giving the water. You get to choose who it is who will receive it. And it's your criteria. You don't have to give it to one or to the other. It is your decision as to who gets to receive it because it is your water. Similar note from Rabbi Dachovsky, who I mentioned in the beginning, in source number 39, where he talks, in fact, about the government of Israel and distribution of water among municipalities. And he says, you view the entire country as one unit, and it's up to the government, like the head of a household, to decide how the family is going to use the resources, and it's legitimate for them to do so. Which means that the doctor, acting as a representative of the healthcare system, does indeed function like the person holding the water in the case in the wilderness, like that third party. And indeed, the system is able to say, you have to make certain decisions about who is going to receive it. It's not something I'm terribly comfortable with. I'm not native to Canada. The idea of this, the doctor saying, I don't want to give you something is a very odd thing for me. Nonetheless, I think that there is significant basis for it within Jewish law. I gave you at the end a set of review questions, and I want to just do a quick run through of them. If people have to leave, we have 1 minute left. If you have to go, you have to go, but please make sure you signed in first. The four Jewish bases for society's duty to fund medical care are the obligation of individuals. They are a set of individuals. That was our first approach. Our second approach was to suggest that the community has a duty to look after the existence of the community. The third approach is the community is doing it as social contract. And the fourth idea is the community has a duty to eliminate injustice, and people lacking medical care is injustice. What two source texts demonstrate that saving lives does not override all of society's other needs? So one was the cap on ransoming captives, and the other was the possibility of Rabbi Yossi that your laundry, may well come ahead of the drinking water needs of another community. How is the balance of healthcare spending versus other spending affected by the basis for society's duty to fund medical care? Meaning the answer to number one will affect the balance of spending on healthcare versus others, right? So that we talked through. I don't think it's I think it's too long for me to sum up in the review. But basically, if you take approach number two, the approach that the community is obligated to look after the existence of the community, that I'm not going to rush through it. It's not going to work that way. I'm just going to garble it then. That question is too complicated for a quick review. I apologize. Does Judaism view preventive medicine and future needs as equal to present therapeutic medicine? And what we've suggested is that that's subject to debate, right? We're going to look at preventive medicine. The preventive medicine for people today, we said, is indeed justified. There's a debate regarding future needs and the statistical patient. How is the question of who makes spending decisions affected by the basis for society's duty to fund medical care? So we said that in the event that you take the approach that it's about the individual's halachic obligations, then a halachic authority should make the decision. In the event that you're looking at it as the community maintaining community, so you ask the researchers what communities need. And if you look at it as social contract, then the elected officials are indeed the ones who decide how to make the spending decisions. Does Judaism accept the idea that helping more people outweighs helping fewer people? Rabbi Yisraeli thinks so, based on the license to go to war. And does Judaism accept the idea that a physician should also serve as a steward of medical resources? Certainly from that Chazon Ish, it seems to be so. There's a lot more to say. I had a lot more material. Maybe we'll come back to this at another time. I said these are first thoughts that have just been 6 years in the works. Thank you very much. I'm going to stick around for questions and discussion. I do ask that people please sign in if you didn't do so already. And God willing, our next session is going to be Sunday morning, January 19th, I believe. It will be at the Bayit in Thornhill. And our topic is seeking psychological counseling in Jewish thought and Jewish law. That's January 19th. Thank you very much.
At what time?
8:45. You'll get 8:45. If you're on the email list, you'll get the information.